Hello, everyone, and thank you for listening to Back Talk by Successful Black Parenting Magazine, the podcast talk show for parents. I'm Janice Robinson-Celeste, your host and publisher of Successful Black Parenting Media. I want you to tell all of your friends and followers about the show. After all, sharing is caring. Know that our hashtag for the show is hashtag Back Talk. Now, my guest for today is Dr. Dakota J. Irby. Dr. Irby is an associate professor in the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Correct? That's correct, right?
Yes, okay. Correct.
I just want to make sure I had it absolutely right.
That's correct.
So can you tell our audience more about yourself and your mission?
Yeah, great. Thank you first for inviting me onto the show. Again, my name is Dakota Irby. I'm a father and partner. I'm a son of a mother who raised me with two sisters in South Carolina. I've lived a lot of places, San Francisco, Philadelphia, and through Milwaukee, Chicago, and through my journeys, I've always found myself, as my wife would call me, always wanting to help everybody. So that's one of the ways that I kind of introduce myself. Sometimes that's a good thing, and sometimes I think it's a tragic, you know, flaw maybe. But I'm a super helpful person. I love young people, love children. I spent years in Philadelphia working with high schoolers in North Philadelphia. That's how I found my way into education. And now I'm blessed to be a father of a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old, raising them here on the south side of Chicago. And I'm very deeply engaged in community, from community gardens to working with my local park council. And so just very engaged parent, and very committed to making sure that my children understand that it takes a village and that they're part of a village.
That's wonderful. Now, I'm from Philly, too, and I also attended Temple University.
Oh, nice.
Long time ago, but I did. So it's good to see you from Philly. It always makes me feel like I'm a little bit connected to the guests when I know we have that Philly connection, because once you're from Philly, you're always from Philly, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you're a parent. So tell us a little bit about the ages of your children. What children do you have? Do you have boys? Do you have girls? How do they affect what you do?
Yeah. So I have two children. I have a son who is 6 years old, and he is incredible. Both of my children are incredible. My daughter is 9 years old. Wow, how did they affect me? I think that they, the biggest impact that they have had on me is helping me to really, really do two things that might seem contradictory, but be very present and be present with them, present in the moment. That's something that I'm continually always having to practice as a parent. And then the other thing is they have really helped me project out and think about a horizon beyond my own lifetime and beyond myself. So those are the two gifts that they've really given me, is the opportunity to really be present in the moment, which children require a lot of presence. And then the other part is really to project out into the future beyond myself. So the way that I move and the decisions that I make are very much in large part about how I want the world to be for them. In addition to how I want it to be for myself, but a lot of it has transitioned to being what I want it to be for them, both in the immediate, if something were to ever happen to me, who do I want them to be around? Who do I want them to know? What stories would I want for people to tell my children about me next week? As well as, what am I leaving behind for them in terms of legacy, in terms of the story of our family, and in terms of, you know, financial and, you know, wealth, right? All of those different sorts of things are what I refer to when I'm saying they help me project out into the future a bit in terms of what I want for them.
All right. I think that drives a lot of parents to make change. It definitely did for me as well. So yeah, children, they're our motivation, our muses, they're our inspiration, they're everything. So it's good to hear. Mm-hmm. Now, let's get into your work a little bit here. You conducted a long form study to analyze the process of racial equity reform within K-12 schools. Can you break that down in layman's terms and tell us about what you discovered and what you were looking for initially?
Sure. So the impetus behind a particular research project that I write about in a book called Stuck Improving, which is available, it's published through Harvard Education Press. in this particular book, basically I was a participant observer. So I worked with the school community and documented their process over a period of 5 years to of them trying to figure out how to make their school a better place for Black and brown children. So the school was historically predominantly white, and then they just started to have an influx of Latinx and Black students. And they were asking themselves the question, like many school districts, suburban school districts ask themselves, like, how can we better support the students that are coming to our doors now? And so what I learned through that process is that school communities, especially ones that are predominantly white, need a lot of support supporting Black and brown children. So much so that I've made the decision to put my children into a school where it's predominantly Black and with mostly Black teachers and staff, a lot of because of what I learned. But there's just a struggle. The core argument that I make in the book is that predominantly white communities don't necessarily have the capacity, the understanding, the knowledge, the skills to really cultivate and bring out the very best of Black and brown children. But it doesn't have to stay that way. And so the silver lining of the book is that despite the fact that I found that, I also discovered many kind of like jewels and breakthroughs that this school community was finding as they made the effort to actually improve the school community for Black and brown children. So in sum, I would say what I learned is that people are making the effort to serve our children. But despite their efforts, oftentimes they're not able to do what I know Black folks can do for our children. And as a consequence, education policymakers and leaders need to put much more emphasis on helping school communities to create the conditions to better serve our students. And for me personally, in the meanwhile, I argue and urge people to think about the trade-offs and some of the costs associated with having Black children in predominantly white school environments. A lot of people talk about the academics being at a different level and that sort of thing. But the phrase that I always thought about is that I can help teach a Black girl. I can help teach my Black children about math and algebra. I can find tutors for that. It's very difficult to recover Black girl magic and Black boy joy. And so my commitment is to making sure they're in an environment where that Black boy joy, that Black girl magic is never questioned. Their brilliance is never questioned, where they're cultivated, where they're nurtured. And all of the academic stuff is really important. That stuff can be taught. It's very difficult to repair children once they've been harmed and diminished by a system. And so my commitment has been to make sure that we create the kind of school communities where Black children and brown children, but Black children in particular, are given the opportunity to just thrive and be affirmed on just a regular basis.
Right. As a former public school teacher, I can tell you that I've experienced that and several things. So that kind of lends to a couple of movements, like we need more Black teachers. So do you think hiring more Black teachers, even in predominantly white schools, will help solve some of those problems? Because I can tell you that I'll go into a little more, but I can tell you I've seen some things, even with Black teachers involved. Noticed that a lot of the white teachers uphold white supremacy, the white female teachers, and they don't even know they're doing it.
Right.
The administration with rules and regulations, for instance, a Black girl and a white girl can have on the same dress. The white girl won't get dress code, but the Black girl will because she has a butt that lifts the dress up a little higher. But if it's her in the front, just fine, hits her knees. And then, of course, I had to advocate being a Black teacher, which a white teacher would not do. I advocated for this Black girl because the white teacher wouldn't even know necessarily to do that. It wouldn't even ring a bell in her head. So, you know, Black teachers tend to protect Black children when they see an injustice, right?
Yes, absolutely.
However, I was in a faculty meeting and they were talking about test scores. And they were saying, trying to say the Black children were bringing down the test scores for the school. But how it was said was a certain group is bringing down our test scores, but our Asian group is helping, right? And so I went, man, my head went, what? You know, very obvious because I wear my emotions on my face and shoulders, right? And then another statement that was made was from a teacher is that some of these students up here are uppity. I went, I just look, you know, like, what? And all the other Black coaches, they were, I was like, you got to be kidding. This is in the South, by the way. And so mm-hmm. I was like, you got to raise your head up and, yeah. you know, you gotta let them know we disapprove of this uppity yeah. statement. But these are the things that happen when, even when Black teachers are involved, a lot of times they'll stick their head in the sand for the sake of their job. So what do you have to say about some of those things that I just talked about?
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen those things too, but, and I've actually seen, you know, some, you know, Black teachers and Black educators, you know, do things that aren't mm-hmm. fair, that are racist towards, you know, Black children too, right? They adopt some yeah. of this kind of ideology and some of the thinking, the punitiveness, mm-hmm. you know, when I hear things like, you know, bathroom breaks being a privilege, right? A privilege as opposed to those are kind of things that.
That's my pet peeve. Sorry.
But it's a trip, but we see yeah. a lot of these things in, you know, all different kinds of schools, but in the particular school where I conducted my research, the Black educators who came in were gifts. They were willing to speak up. And I should also mention that in this particular school, there were folks, white folks in particular, who were making an intentional effort to attract a particular kind of Black person, a particular kind of Black educator that would, you know, push them to get better, as you mentioned, to help them see things that they might not have seen before. So many of the people in this particular school community were really in kind of a learner stance where they were open and willing and trying to learn. And so, yeah, so it can be rough in all different kinds of school communities. I mean, we live in a society that, you know, devalues and, you know, diminishes, you know, Black children, which is why it's so important to have, you know, not just Black educators, but educators who are committed to affirming and supporting and giving the right kind of academic press and the warm demanding that, you know, our children need and deserve if they're going to be able to thrive. So I say Black educators are critically important, and Black educators who love Black children are what we really want. So I'm super committed to that. I'm actually the director of the Call Me Mr. Initiative at University of Illinois Chicago. And the mission of Call Me Mr. Initiative is to increase the number of Black and Latinx males that go into elementary school teaching. Many of them go to high schools, but elementary is a really, really formative stage for children. And so they kind of form their career ambitions and who they want to be and what they want to be relatively early, in particular as relates to teaching. Most teachers, if you talk to them and you say, when did you know you want to be a teacher? Typically, they say, I knew, you know, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade. So it's really important to have Black teachers who care for and support students, especially in those early grades. And the Mr. Initiative is an effort to try to do that.
I'm so happy to hear that you're doing that. And it's really needed. I could tell you, you know, there's so much unconscious biases in schools, with especially, you said, with even Black teachers. And I can see that, but definitely some white teachers. I gave this example before in a show where we had some roamers, what we call roamers, kids that don't want to stay put in the classroom. They want to get a hall pass and go roam and go see their favorite teachers and things like that. So I remember hearing one teacher talk about two students of mine who also, you know, she had in her classroom, and one was Black and one was white. And she talked about them at different times, but the white kid that roamed around, they both had like amazing charisma. You know, they were going to go, they could be the best salesmen in the world. Like that's the skills that they had, right? Mm-hmm. Convince you of anything. But the white kid, she was like, oh, he's going places. He's doing things. He's amazing and whatever. When she talked about the Black kid who's doing the same exact thing, it was, oh, he gets on my nerves. He's always roaming the hallways. I done wrote him up 5 times. Right. I was like, I had to say something. And I was like, what? Why would you do that? He's going to be an amazing person. He's going to, you know, he's going to excel. You nurture that character trait, you know, even though he's not supposed to be in the hallway all the time, you can give him a leadership role where he can do something, where he can travel the hallways. And I happen to have a class, I taught television production. So they were able to roam the hallways to take, you know, video and all that kind of stuff, photographs and things like that. But yeah, so these are the kind of things that I personally saw. So I think that it is important, because the school systems all over the country have traditionally had white women as teachers for, you know, centuries. So now we need to see, especially Black males as role models. And it's so hard though, because teachers are often the most disrespected job that you can get.
Yep.
And on a daily basis. And it's good once you get the respect of the children, but then you always have new groups coming in. And it can be just one group that will ruin it for you, you know, one click. And I've had that where I had to actually leave the classroom and cry, you know, call the dean to take my class because I was like, I can't. And they were Black kids. And I was like, I can't get through them. And it was killing me that I could not get through to them, that they had to be better than the rest, you know, and it was killing me. And they were just the worst, I got to say, just acting the worst they possibly could act. And we had the same group with the teacher across the, a Black teacher across the hall trying to break up a fight. And they snatched her wig off her head. And she quit that day because she was so disrespected. So the pay isn't good.
Right.
You have to be in it for the mission. And it's there are hard days. But then there's also those groups that will make your day, or one student that will say something amazing that will you'll need for that day to hear to keep you going. So it definitely is a difficult job.
Yeah, it definitely is. And, you know, media and how teachers are portrayed in the media doesn't help.
No.
The way that, you know, the, you know, elected officials, you know, try to control everything about what teachers are doing as though they can't make good decisions as a profession for themselves. So it's, you know, teachers get it and people in the teaching profession get it from all angles, you know, from students and, you know, from parents who think that, you know, teachers, you know, don't know how to do their jobs. And, you know, so it's a tough place to be. It's definitely a tough profession. And, but we found, you know, it's finding Black males that want to go into elementary school teaching and Latinx males who want to go into elementary school teaching is a serious challenge. Yeah. A lot of them are more likely to gravitate towards, you know, the high school age students. So the elementary piece is very challenging. It's like finding a needle in a haystack. So when we get them, we try to provide all of the support and encouragement. And what we found is that, you know, the cohort and them having kind of like the camaraderie of other males is like really, really important in terms of helping them persist and even persist in their interests as well as like, you know, their studies to become, you know, elementary school teachers. But those early grades are just super, super important.
Great. I agree. I absolutely agree. I can tell you I had only one Black male my entire school career from K through 12.
Yeah, and, my K through 12, I had one. Wow. I had one. We had, you know, people who were like assistant coaches and that sort of thing. But we did not have, you know, we had people who were principals, but they were more like in a disciplinarian role. Mm-hmm. They weren't people that you turn to for intellectual guidance to be curious with and that would help make you curious. They were typically in a school environment for to play a role in, you know, discipline and control. And, you know, it sets up an antagonistic relationship between our children and Black men when, you know, the primary role that you see them in is, you know, this antagonistic role as the disciplinarian, as opposed to what could be the case, the intellectual person who can be curious with you and a person who, and this is for all students, who, you know, gives you feedback. You know, one of the interesting things is as, you know, working in higher education, many, many students that I encounter, I'm the first Black male that they've ever had as a professor, as a teacher. And it's a trip because, you know, a lot of them can't handle the feedback. You know, they can be 30, 35 years old and never have had a Black man tell them that something that they try to do in terms of their intellectual capacities is not where it needs to be. And they have room for growth. And that's hard for a lot of people, you know, across the board. That's they haven't had access to, you know, Black men who they have to think of as people who can push them and help them grow intellectually.
Well, they better get used to it.
Yeah.
That's what I have to say. So what can our parents do to affect positive change in the school system?
So I think one of the things that parents can do is I think begin to be more interested, curious, and ask more questions about what is happening in terms of instruction. This is a big thing. So many times parents, you know, one of the things that I'm always mindful of is that people engage the way they kind of know how to engage and what they know what to engage with. And so a lot of times what you see as parental engagement, parental involvement is like volunteering to like, you know, do a fundraiser or maybe be a playground monitor or, you know, to, you know, helps the students get in and out of the car if you're like down in the South where they do the car drop-offs. Mm-hmm. So parents play those kind of roles. And the thing that I would encourage parents to do is to get much more curious and ask a lot more questions about what students are learning, not about their grades necessarily. Most parents use the grades, they use the report cards as an indicator that students are learning, but that's not always the case. The most important question that parents can ask their child is not how did you do or what grade did you get or how did you do on the test. The most important question and the question that I ask my children every day when they come home is what did you learn today that you didn't know yesterday? And if they can answer that question every day, that's good. If they can't, there's a problem. That's different than saying how did you perform on the test? What were your grades? And this is the same exact question we should be asking to teachers and to their teachers. So when you have those teacher conferences and those meetings, the teachers want to start off with saying, here's the grades that they earned. That's mm-hmm. not the right thing that we should be focused on. Grades are important. The more important thing that you should ask the teacher is, what did the students learn this quarter? Tell me that. And then ask your students, what are you learning? Figure out whether what they learned, what they were supposed to learn, and what your student says, your child says that they learned, if those things are coherent and they all align, now you're in good business. Part of the antagonistic relationship that gets set up is that we go in and parents will go in, and as teachers too, start to use the grade as the entry point for the discussion. The grade should not be the entry point for the discussion. What students are learning and what they should have learned and what they should be learning should be the entry point for the discussion at all times.
I like that. I really do. I also think that schools need to come into the future a little bit with using technology in the sense of I would allow my parents to text me because they gave us all, you know, laptops, right? So you have the Messenger app on the Apple computers that we had. We had desktop and we had the laptop. So if parents text today, why can't they text their teacher and get updates on the kids? Why do we have to do it through necessarily emails or on the phone or necessarily a parent conference that takes parents away from their job? Mm-hmm. They can text regularly. They can do it daily. They can do it weekly. Also, Zoom and FaceTime. Yeah. I had that capacity too. So I would tell my parents, look, I'm done at 4. You know, of course, I had with TV club in a couple of days. But on those days I didn't, these are the days you can contact me, like office hours, and you can FaceTime me. I'll be in front of my computer. Yeah. Because this is what we do today. So I think that's a way that I think schools need to start looking at getting parents involved, even though it's not face to face, it's not direct that in that sense, but it does get them in the loop of what's going on with their child in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that I found really fascinating during the pandemic when we shifted to virtual learning, it was one of the first times that like parents really had access to what happens in the classroom.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? So now everybody's like, whoa, wait, I didn't know that these people was getting called on. And you know, you see the same patterns, right? The boys aren't called on. You see who's engaged. You get to hear kind of like the teacher, you know, how they're interacting with the students and that sort of thing. So I thought it was a good opportunity for parents to start to get a better sense of what happens in classrooms and that sort of thing. But I think that the biggest piece is what are you learning? Tell me what you learned today. Explain this to me. Those are the questions that if every parent were having those conversations with their young people, it actually then begins to set the expectation that students don't necessarily talk about grades, but they talk about their learning. And so, you know, I'm in, you know, I work in leadership. And so one of the things that I look for in a school community where there's a lot of learning taking place is that students can actually answer that question. If you go into a classroom and you say, what are you learning and why, they can tell you, they can answer those two questions. And if things are working out the way they should, they can answer those when they're 5, 6 years old, 7 years old. You know, here's what I'm learning. Here's why it's important. And those are two things that we should be asking all the time. And Yeah. So I think that that's probably the most important thing, that if parents started to do that, they learn a lot about their children, as well as the kind of teaching and learning that's happening in their child's school.
So you mean don't give up after your kid says, I don't know.
Yeah.
Push a little bit, right? Because they all say that at first.
They all say that at first. So it's an everyday thing. You know, I mean, you know, it's always, I always ask my children too, you know, how was school today? Tell me about what you learned. And then I often ask them, not every day, but a lot of times, how are people treating you? Is anybody being mean to you? Are people being nice to you? Tell me about somebody who's been nice to you. And is anybody being mean to you? And tell me who's being mean to you. And with children and young people, you gotta ask direct, specific questions. If you leave it open-ended, they're gonna be like, oh, it's okay. How was school? Oh, it's okay. No, my thing is like, what did you learn? Tell me what you learned that you didn't know, you know, a couple of days ago. Tell me how people are treating you. Are people nice to you? Give me an example. What's something that somebody nice did to you or did for you? What's something that you did for somebody else that was nice? Is anybody being mean to you? Tell me about that. And I ask my children those questions pretty much on a very regular basis. And I get a lot of good information from asking those questions, but they have to be specific.
Wow, that is excellent. I really like that. And it opens up a conversation. So you're right, open-ended questions. So if you guys hear that, make sure you don't ask, what did you do in school today, without like even elaborating on that. Don't be like, oh, okay, what did you learn today? Even who did you sit next to at lunch today? Who's your favorite friend in school? You know, those are all great questions. So I really love that you asked that. Now let's talk about your work a little bit in your books. You talked about design thinking and continuous improvement methods. Why are they essential in rooting out problems?
Yeah. So continuous improvement and design thinking is really, well, a lot of what I like to think of in terms of design thinking is about how do you design kind of learning opportunities with the kind of like user in the middle, right? And so it's this idea of like, you know, thinking about the person who is intended to benefit most. So it's almost like, you know, if somebody's teaching or if you're a parent, instead of thinking about, I'm going to parent this way, you know, I'm going to say these particular things, I'm going to, you know, ask my child these particular questions. Instead, like similar to the example that I gave before, understanding that a 6 or 9 year old or even a teenager is going to be like, whatever, you know, you have to put yourself in their situation and ask the questions in a kind of more pointed way that gives them the opportunity to elaborate. And so the idea of continuous improvement is it's an organizational kind of like improvement approach. Mm-hmm. And basically, it's just a process of, most people think of it as in the most basic sense, it's kind of like a plan, act, and then kind of like revise. So you're always thinking about how do you get better at whatever it is you're doing. So you're asking questions, a lot of questions. I want to accomplish, you know, goal A. I want, for example, I'll give a concrete example. I feel like I need to give a concrete example. So getting my children to do their chores or to do chores at all was quite a challenge. And so I designed a process for them where I gave them the materials, understanding children, I think, like to do things. They see adults do things. They like to do things if they're given the permission to. So I gave them dry erase. One day I came home with dry erase markers and a dry erase board. And I said, y'all know all of the things that need to be done in the house. I want you all to organize your schedule so that you can do a chore a day. And they did it. And I said, whatever the chores are, I'm gonna let you decide. Y'all get to decide. And so they gave themselves, clean their bathroom, change the fish tank water, water the plants, take out the trash. And they kind of just organized it all by themselves. All I had to do was stand to the side. They included their homework. They included all of these things. Now, once they had that there, I just had to say, this is what y'all said y'all was gonna do. I gave y'all the, you know, the flexibility to choose which chores. Y'all ain't want to do dishes or sweep. That's cool. I'll take care of that. But y'all got to have something that you're doing every day. And so these are things now. And then we also talked about, OK, what happens if you don't do those things? OK, well, Saturday is supposed to be a free day. My children can only play Nintendo Switch when they get home Fridays after school. They can only play video games on the weekends. Saturday is supposed to be a free day and Sunday is supposed to be kind of a family day. But they decided for themselves that if they don't get all of their chores done by Friday, that they know they can't play Nintendo Switch until all of their chores, they're caught up on all of their chores. So just having just the design process was, since they were going to be the people doing the chores, I put them at the center of the process of designing the schedule and how they wanted to actually go about doing it. Then what I had to do is provide the support for them to do it. You know, everything from, you know, teaching them how to actually get the bathroom clean the right way, my right way, right? And just working with them on it and being patient and being present and not taking the scrubbing tools from them. And it might not be as clean as I would make it, but in time it will be, because I let them get started. And then a few weeks later, I can say, y'all are getting really good. There's another thing that I want you to think about. You're only getting the bottom part of the tub. I want you to get the walls too, right? So that's the continuous improvement process of helping them get to the point where, you know, they'll be able to do it in a way that, you know, is, I guess, satisfactory to me. But really putting them at the center of the process is what the design-based process is like. For them to design the schedule, the ways that they want to do it, and then I need to provide them the resources and give them the opportunity to think about how to continuously get better and more efficient at what the chores are that they decided to do. Now, that doesn't mean that it's perfect, but we always have a really good place to start, because sometimes I have to. I don't have to be like, you know, you got to do your chores. But I can say like, look, y'all said y'all was going to do y'all chores. I just want y'all to know that y'all decided that there's no Nintendo Switch until you get this taken care of. And my son, especially, he takes care of it because he really loves the Nintendo Switch. Now, my daughter's challenging because she'll just say, well, I don't want to play Nintendo Switch tonight anyway, you know. But at least it puts them in the center and it gives us a place in terms of their agency to create the process. They're at the center of it. So I don't have to talk to them about what I want them to do. I can talk to them about how they contribute to the household, how they contribute to the family based on what they said they were going to do. And that always becomes our entry point for negotiating kind of around doing chores around the house.
Okay. Well, we're getting short on time. So what I want to do is make sure we cover your book, Stuck Improving, and put up here for a second between us.
Yes, thank you.
And Stuck Improving, Racial Equity and School Leadership. Can you tell us a little bit about that and the title?
Yeah. So the idea of Stuck Improving is an idea that really captures the idea that when you make progress, it might not feel like you're making progress. And sometimes you take two steps forward and you take a couple steps back. The idea is supposed to convey that when we're focused on issues of racial equity and progress, that it's not a linear, straightforward process, but it is circular, that there's back and forth and there's tensions involved with making progress. The most important thing that I want people to walk away from the book understanding is that when you are involved in a process of trying to make a school community more racially equitable for Black and brown children, that there's going to be periods where you feel like you're not making progress. But the awareness and the consciousness of when you're not making progress is a resource to help you understand what you need to do to then make further progress. So that's the, you know, summary of what the idea of Stuck Improvement means. And the book elaborates on that central idea.
Okay, but you also wrote this book right here. Sorry to cover up, but Magical Black Tears, and it's a children's book, you guys.
Yes.
And it's a protest story. So what is that about?
So that book stemmed from a dream that I had, actually. And it was a very vivid dream. I woke up one night and I actually just sketched out what I saw in the dream. But it's about parents. It's about two children, loosely based off of my family and their parents, trying to do what they can to protect them from what's happening in the world. If we think about 2020 and the racial uprisings, police brutality, and there's these two parents who are very committed to trying to protect their children from those harsh realities of racism that exist in the world. And the children, being curious as children are, decide that they want to understand what's going on in their neighborhood because there's police and there's smoke and there's fire. And they leave the house at night to go on adventure to learn what's happening in their neighborhood. And I'll leave it there. But I'll say that what they discover is the magical power of everyday people fighting for racial justice.
Oh, that's great. So how can we get these books? Where can we find them? What's the best place?
Yeah. So the Magical Black Tears book is let me start with the Stuck Improving book. If you Google it, it's available on Amazon. It's also available through Harvard Education Press. The Magical Black Tears book is one that is for sale direct from my consulting group called The Root Consulting Cooperative. We sell it directly. It's not available on Amazon because every dollar that comes from this book touches Black and women-owned firms from the printer to the graphic designer to everybody. So we made a decision, at least for the first couple of years, that we would not make this book available on Amazon or any of those other online retailers, because we actually want the money to be circulated within the Black community. With that in mind, you can find and you can purchase the book directly at magicalblacktears.com.
That's easy. Thank you so much for that. I just want to thank you for coming on the show today. So I could talk to you for another hour for sure. But thank you. You really enlightened us with your research and with your books. I'm glad that you decided to come on our show, Back Talk.
I appreciate the invitation. Thank you so much.
Sure. Okay. And thank you all for participating and listening to Back Talk by Successful Black Parenting Magazine, the videocast and syndicated podcast talk show for parents. Don't forget to follow us too on Twitter and Facebook at Black Parenting One. In the future, you have to go to our Facebook page to have your comments show up on the show. So if you go just Google Black Parenting One, you'll find us there. On Instagram, we are Successful Black Parenting. Again, our website is also successfulblackparenting.com, and it's full of great content to help you to thrive and not just survive as a parent. Be sure to rate our podcast. And until next time, I wish you all the best and much success. Take care.